Well, you see the price of gasoline at the pumps, right? Seems pretty low these days, but it's not going to be that way forever. No, no, no. Electric, maybe that's the way to go. Brooks Agnew has got a company, and he's manufacturing electric trucks. He'll give us an update on it when we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to this edition of Coast to Coast AM with Dr. Brooks Agnew. Brooks, let's get into your work with this electric truck. How did this come about?
Well, that's a good question. I actually was an engineer in the automotive industry for a long, long time. I retired in 2006 after almost 25 years in the business. I worked for General Motors and Toyota and did some contracts for Chrysler and Ford, and helped launch the Nissan Altima in the early 90s. So I learned a lot about manufacturing vehicles, but it was kind of a roller coaster when car sales were very good. It was a great industry to be in. When they were bad, it was not so good.
Not so good. Not
so I really had a passion for alternative energy. So I started a small company, and I was asked by some folks in the state of Washington to come up there and build a biodiesel plant for them in 2007 that crushed canola seed and turned it into biodiesel. It was an interesting challenge, especially building something industrial-sized, and it was very rewarding. But during that period, gasoline prices went through the roof. I mean, like, gasoline jumped over $5 a gallon, so I had a lot of my contacts and the automotive industry that called me and said, hey, you remember those electric cars you played with back in the 90s? You know, you're interested in it. You should consider building one. So that sort of lit the fuse. I built a car in 2008. I took an old attempt at an electric car that someone had thrown away, and I refurbished it and got it running, and that let me know that I could do it. So then I went back to my folks in Detroit, and I said, listen, what does the market look like in, say, 2011? And they said, well, you know, there are a couple cars in the queue. There's probably going to be two or maybe three electric cars on the road by 2011, but there aren't going to be any trucks. So I took the car apart. I improved the technology, filed a few patents, and I built my first truck in 2009.
Great idea.
That was amazing. We took it on a four-state tour, and this was not a golf cart. This was a highway-ready truck that could haul stuff, and it was fast. And I put some investment together, put some of my own money into it, and slowly but surely, we've been working our way through all of the government regulations, safety and emissions and things like that, and now we have a truck that has just recently completed all of its crash simulation testing, and we're ready to file our report with the DOT. So it looks like later on this year, we're going to be approved to sell this truck in the U.S.
That's exciting. What's it going to retail for?
New. I mean, they've been around back in 1885, I think they first started making their appearance in the United States. And by 1906, 1907, 70% of the vehicles on the road in the cities were electric. Trucks, cars, buses, trains. And it makes sense because in those days, yes, there were gasoline-powered motors around, but there were no electric starters. And women could not start the gasoline motors. They didn't want to. They were in dresses and they wore gloves. But they loved the electric vehicles because they were quiet and they didn't smell and they didn't make any noise. And they were very popular.
What are you going to retail it for?
This truck, because of all the requirements that we've had to put into it, is going to retail without rebates or anything at about $50,000. So it's very affordable. By the time you take a couple of years of fuel and the rebates you're eligible for, you're way ahead of the game from buying a full-size truck.
But it's a real truck. It's not going to be like one of those little carts or anything like that.
No, this is, you know, we converted a lot of vehicles, but one of the things we found, and this is what the majors are finding as well, is if you convert a vehicle that was once a gasoline vehicle into electric, it doesn't work because the vehicle's too heavy. It has a lot of infrastructure that's designed for a gas-powered motor that you don't need for an electric. So we built our truck from the ground up as an electric vehicle. Now, we've had our effect because you can see the commercials already trying to catch up with us. We built a truck that's 1,500 pounds lighter than a full-size pickup. It will carry 1,000 pounds, 100 miles on about a penny and a half a mile.
That's not bad.
It's pretty good, and it accelerates quick, 0 to 60. Well, you could program it to 6 seconds, which is about like an old, 1969 Roadrunner, or you can program it to sip amps and really stretch your range out there well over 100 miles.
How fast can it go?
I am, a former racer, and it goes so fast that I am not willing to push it all the way down. We have one that we're building right now. Of course, this is an exhibition truck, but it'll break 9 seconds in a quarter mile.
That's pretty good.
That's really good. It reaches about 136 miles an hour long before it gets to the end of the quarter mile. Now, this isn't a truck you could buy, but it's so much torque, so much power. It's just really incredible how we've built this drive that has almost no drag to it at all. And it's once you get used to the acceleration, you don't want to go back to a gas-powered vehicle.
How would you compare it to Tesla's in terms of how it works, the engine?
Well, that's a good question. I know the founders of Tesla, the original team that converted the Lotus, and they had limitations, the same limitations we have today, but they had a lot of them then, and that was there weren't any batteries, and so they started their technology with a little over 1,000 computer batteries, and that's pretty much where they are today. I think they use 1,168 little batteries and sheets, and they immerse them in a cooling solution so they can keep them cool. But the battery technology's come a long way as far as larger batteries able to do the work with less connections. So in that respect, Tesla's behind us. But in the respect that they have built a sports car sedan that's fun to drive, it's affordable to drive, we have had lots of Tesla drivers come to our plant and drive our truck. They absolutely love the truck.
So, will you revolutionize the truck business?
I would say a portion of it because, for a long time, about 30 years in this country, you could buy a small pickup truck. You could buy what we call a 10-foot wheelbase truck, 125
People love
inch wheelbase.
trucks, by the way. They love them.
Yeah, but they stopped making them in 2011. Ford Ranger went out of production, and that was the last one hanging on by its fingernails, primarily because of safety regulations. In 2011, they changed the roof crush specification to 3 times the weight of the vehicle instead of 2 times the weight of the vehicle. That would have required a complete redesign of the cab of the Ranger. Small trucks have never been, for the majors, a very big seller. About 55,000-58,000 vehicles a year is it. That's a fraction of what the full-size truck market is. So it's not really a big enough market for them to invest the money in all that tooling, especially since the other regulation, which is the CAFE regulations, requiring small trucks to get at least 23 mpg, and it was very shortly going to become 26 miles per gallon, they simply couldn't do it with a V6. So they just got out of the business. So what we theorized was that there are about 18 million small trucks still on the road. A lot of them are quite old, but the average age is a little over 11 years. That's a lot of people that like driving small trucks. And maybe we can access a niche of that market with electric. Now, when you say better, let me qualify that.
Okay.
If you operate a truck inside a city, like let's say Los Angeles, how often can you really go freeway speeds in Los Angeles?
You're stop and go all the time.
Pretty much. In fact, a recent statement by the Secretary of Transportation, Mr. Anthony Fox, he said that the average American spends about $1,000 a year idling their cars. Now, that's $1,000 a year you could put right back in your pocket. because when our vehicle stopped, it isn't using any energy at all, unless you're running the lights or the air conditioning or the heat.
Brooks, what's the range on this?
Well, it depends on how you drive. If you drive that 0 to 60 in 6 seconds I was talking about, you're going to get probably less than 100 miles, but it's going to be a fun less than 100
Yeah.
miles. If you drive the posted speed limit, we've built this truck that almost any condition, any load you can put in it will go at least 100 miles.
And will you see a gauge that which basically shows you the battery life on it?
Yes. Now, this is a kind of a moving target for electric vehicles because the state of charge updates all the time. About every couple minutes, it lets you know this is how far you can go if you continue driving the way you've been driving in the last 2 minutes. It's not like, a gas tank. But I answer these questions all the time because people have succumbed to a very clever propaganda campaign that has generated a term that actually doesn't exist. It's called range anxiety. Range anxiety. That means, according to people that I ask about it, well, that means what happens if I get out there and it runs out of charge? I can't just go get a can of electrons, and pour it in the tank and keep going. And I ask them back the question, have you ever run out of gas? And most of the people say, well, yeah, I have run out of gas. And I ask them, well, how was the engine performing the moment before you ran out of gas? It was performing fine. I was cruise control on the freeway doing 75 miles an hour, and it sputtered to a stop, and I slapped my forehead and said, oh, man, I forgot to gas up. That doesn't happen in an electric vehicle. In electric vehicles, you get all kinds of warnings that you're getting low on charge. The motor begins to get sluggish. You can't reach 75 miles an hour very easily. And people that drive electric vehicles know that feeling. Now, the difference is that there are a lot more places to charge up than there are to get gas. So, range anxiety for electric vehicle owners does not exist. They fit it into their lifestyle and they save thousands of dollars a year in fuel.
Did you try at all of building a hybrid, part electricity, part gasoline?
No, basically a hybrid is a baby step. What they're trying to do is keep all the employees that they had before making gasoline-powered cars and add batteries to it to assist it. Now, the difference between a hybrid and a battery assist is that a hybrid actually runs a generator that runs the electric motor that drives the vehicle, and it also charges the batteries. And a battery assisted has a gas-powered transmission and drivetrain, and then it has an electric motor to assist the engine. Big trucks, buses, and one electric truck that's out there uses a battery assist. What we did, and what I think Chevy Volt should have done, is take that $5,000 motor out of there, put some more batteries in it, and make it pure electric. Nissan did that. I'm really proud of having worked for Nissan. I'm proud of the company Nissan. They built an all-electric sedan to go out there and compete with in the Prius market. And it is, well, last year they had the first year of over 30,000 vehicles sold, and it's
That's
taking off
amazing.
from there.
That is something else. Well, it's happening. It's the wave of the future. I mean, it's just inevitable, isn't it?
Well, you say that, but in 1906, it was the wave of the future then. Then we got away from it and we went to gasoline. And I got to admit, for a long time, gasoline was cheap. It was cheap. But when
Yeah.
you get big cities like Salt Lake and LA and Atlanta, the smog gets horrific. And when you think to yourself, I don't have to drive 300 miles at a stint most of the time. Most of the time, I'm driving 40 or 50 miles a day. Do that driving with the electric, and then just keep your gas-powered car for those trips that you have to make to San Diego every now and then. And then it makes a lot more sense. It keeps the environment clean for sure, but it makes more economic sense.
Well, I got to tell you, it should be the wave of the future, but with the prices of gasoline as low as they are right now, does that hurt you?
It It does, in the sense that people don't necessarily have the fever to go after a gasoline-powered truck. But we're not marketing to consumers. We're marketing directly to commercial fleets. In that respect, we're not selling the truck to the driver. We're selling the truck to the accountant. And what the accountant sees when they have, let's say, 6 or 7,000 trucks in their fleet, is that they're writing enormous checks every month for gasoline, every week for gasoline. What our vehicle does is it cuts their cost of operation from 28 to 35 cents a mile down to 2 cents a mile, takes away almost all the maintenance because there's no oil, no water, no belts, no hoses. You know, there's only 7 moving parts in the vehicle. It cuts down on their maintenance, it cuts down on their fuel, and it preserves the cash flow because they only have to pay for electricity once a month instead of buying gas twice a week.
That's not bad. What's the plant look like, and how many people ultimately will you employ?
That's a great question. We have a plant in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's kind of unique in the sense that it used to make a pigment for inks and dyes.
Hmm.
And in the early 80s, they had a dreadful mistake and they turned the Catawba River purple. And the EPA descended upon them and shut the whole place down. And it, for the next 20-something years, they were cleaning it up, hauling off dirt, hauling off tanks and pipes and things like that.
Ink stains.
Finally, after all that process, this whole Superfund process, this property was determined to be clean. And so an entrepreneur came in, worked out a lease option with the former owners, and turned it into a green industrial park called ReVenture Park. And there are now 4 green businesses inside this 650-acre facility. We're the biggest. And right now, we're in winter shutdown, but when we were running last summer, we had 13 people. When we start up for production, when the DOT gives us clearance, we'll have around 300 people at this facility.
Good for you. Good for you. So you expect this to hit the market exactly when?
We're taking reservations right now because when you're putting together a vehicle, you really need to have a forecast for your parts.
Yep, that's what Paul Elio's doing with his little 3-wheeler.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of
his is gasoline.
We call them, you know, kind of going around the mountain. They create a motorcycle with
that's
3
right.
wheels, and they put a body around it and call it a car.
Yeah.
But
no,
technically,
it's a motorcycle.
Really a motorcycle.
Yeah, he admitted that too.
So you don't have to go through all the safety regulations, and that's because they don't want to spend a couple $1 million to go through the safety regulations. Those vehicles ultimately fail because they're just too far outside of what the average person will drive. This vehicle looks like a pickup truck, except it has a trunk in the front and it's very aerodynamic. But once you drive it for a couple of miles, you'll never go back to a regular gas-powered truck for driving around town.
Do you have one now for yourself?
I have 3, and we're working on 5 more, which have an integrated steel roll cage in the body.
What's the name of the company, Brooks?
The name of the company?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of commercial. It's EV Fleet, like electric vehicle fleet.
EV
Not
fleet.
Very sexy.
Are you ever going to go public?
That's a good question.
We're always looking for new ventures.
Well, companies go public to raise money or to exit investors.
Right.
However, you know, these days, hanging your laundry out for the public to see and having to report all the time everything that goes on inside the company is not so desirable if you want to keep making vehicles and stay in business. We don't have that problem. We actually have partners in the oil business, and we're okay as far as funding. Would they ever want to exit by selling, you know, public? Maybe. Would we ever want to build a couple more models, like maybe a sports car or a minivan? Maybe. In that respect, we'd probably have to go public because to launch a vehicle like that would be a couple of $100 million.
All right, we're going to come back and talk about the shadow government next. It's called the shadow government. Exactly what do they do, and what do they want to do to us? We'll check in with Dr. Brooks Agnew when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. The shadow government, Brooks Agnew, the shadow government. They've been around for a long time, haven't they?
They have been around for a long time. And, you know, we left that in early Europe when, you know, all of the innovation, all of the opportunity for the average person to reach a dream or to accomplish something or work their way out of their circumstances was taken away from them for so long that when the opportunity to risk it all and get on a wooden ship and sail across the Atlantic to lands in the frontier and brave the elements and illness and risk and injury to make their fortune was irresistible. And after about 200 years, we had a sizable colony here that was being taxed by Europe. And this experiment called America was birthed out of that. The Declaration of Independence and the subsequent Constitution by which we established a republic where people are represented in government and it serves at the pleasure of the people was established. And, you know, when the Constitutional Convention happened and we ratified that as a country, we moved forward from there, with certainly some growing pains. But by the early 1900s, we had a quandary. The European banks, the transatlantic banks, could not get a grip on the colonies. We had unbelievable resources here and the willpower and the strength to mine it or chop it down or forge it, and we were going ahead, but we were going ahead without the European banks, and that just was not acceptable. And they tried repeatedly to get a global bank presence in this country, and they couldn't do it. By 1928, I mean, everybody in this country was getting rich. The Wall Street was could do no wrong. You could with $1 you could leverage $1,000 worth of stock and it would be worth $100,000 within 6 months.
Jeez.
It was almost like the stock market is now. And it got inflated to the point where finally when the banks got a hold of it, in 1910 they created a Federal Reserve. By 18 years later, they had a good grip on the banks, and they collapsed the money supply. When they did, 1929, the market crashed. Well, at the time, Hoover was president, first-termer, engineer, trying to solve problems and squeeze waste and duplication out of government. Well, his term was over. So in comes this flamboyant, well-publicized governor of New York, Mr. Roosevelt, and he wins. And in a year, literally a year, he begins to put the first agencies together.
Yeah,
I'm
he was talking about Secretary of
Defense. I'm talking about the CCC and the FCC, and all of these agencies began to be created, and they were given purview over basic things that were free in this republic.
Once all this started, when did they, and we talk about who they might be, when did they say we need to control everything? Was it this period?
It's a gradual process. We're talking an 81-year process. And what it really did, you know, we have three branches of government that stay pretty much in check and balance. We have a legislative, an executive, and a judicial branch. That's the way it's written. What happened was a fourth branch of government began to form. And it was naturally not transparent. What would happen is Congress would pass a law. The law would be passed on to the agency, which was given purview over that law, and then they would write regulations to implement that law on the street level. There's no review process for those regulations. Once they're issued by the agency, they have the force of law. Now, when I say it has the force of law, it can be sued in court, and it took a long time for it to get its legs, for it to get, you know, dug in where it could push with some force. What they realized very early on is that they had to be the aggressors with the legal cases. They lost a lot in the beginning. And they realized that they had to start engineering their cases, planning them, so that they could win them in progression, so that each win would be the precedent for the next and the next and the next. They had a long-range view, but in 81 years, they were able to get complete control over everything we do. Everything in the United States is now controlled, or soon will be, by February 26th, it will be controlled by this federal arm of the government. The dangerous thing about this is that if you go to the Constitution, it describes where the president can have a cabinet. Now, early on, this cabinet was called secretaries. You had a secretary of state, a secretary of defense, a secretary of the interior, those kinds of things. Well, the secretaries by statute are the ones that interpret the regulations. They're the ones that interpret the main clause in any regulation. So the secretary has tremendous influence over, let's call it, prosecutorial discretion over those regulations. It took a while for presidents to learn they had this power. President Bush, the second one, is probably the one that took the biggest chunk out of that freedom with things like the Defense Authorization Act and the War Powers Act and on and on. We really forget about how much power George W. Bush took away from the American people. But the next president, President Barack Hussein Obama, when you talk about transparency, I guess he's right. He just stepped in and fundamentally transformed the country.
In
Congress
which way? Just
completely lost control of the
by
country.
just taking everything, right? Under executive actions?
Well, you have executive orders, which he has probably written about the average amount, but then you have executive memoranda on top of that. And when you combine those two, he has written almost 400 of them, and he still has 2 years to go. I don't know that he's writing them because some of these are quite complex, and they have penalties that go with them. You can go to prison. They can seize your property. They can tax you. They can fine you out of executive orders, which is really not what they were designed to do in the first place. It really bothered me because I was in an industry where I was trying to break away from gas-powered vehicles and make electric vehicles, and I was running into the same regulatory obstacles that I was when I was in the gasoline-powered business. And I said, "But wait a minute, we don't have emissions. We make a toaster. We don't have an exhaust pipe. We should be able to go around that." "No, no, no, no. You got to go completely through that. You got to pay all the fees just like you were a gas-powered vehicle." So I got frustrated with it, and I started digging and doing researching. George, you know how I am. I get to a certain
Oh,
point,
you're
I go, "This
like
has got to
a, yeah,
change."
you don't
So
stop.
I wrote a book in 2012 called Alienated Nation. And it went to number one on Amazon in politics and government, and it called for an Article 5 convention. We've never had one in this country. It's a little risky because there aren't many guidelines for it in the Constitution, but the states can get together in the right amount, two-thirds, and they can call for a convention. And once they do, Congress has to open the convention. The states then can make amendments to the Constitution. They can repeal them, they can pass them. Once they're passed, then they have to go back to the states and be passed by a three-quarters majority. Well, right now, there are 40 states that are involved in an effort to try to get that Article 5 convention passed. The problem is those 40 states don't see eye to eye. They all want different things. And there are some outside monies that are trying to get involved in that and influence that constitutional convention. So we risk losing our form of government altogether. But if we do nothing, it's already lost.
Are they afraid of us?
The one thing that probably keeps the idea of America alive is the prospect that there are 300 million armed Americans out here. Now, I'm not saying that there would be a revolution. I'm not ever saying there would be any kind of violence whatsoever. It's not the actual violence that keeps government at bay. It's the prospect of that violence that keeps them at bay. It's the fact that if there's any people on the face of the earth that could escalate something like a heavy-handed overreach faster, I don't think there is one. It could escalate so fast right here in the United States. When the people are mad at government and government makes a move in a militaristic way to overreach, they're going to be resisted. We've already seen that on a small scale in LA and Ferguson and other places.
People like Henry Kissinger, they still keep going. They're like the Energizer Bunny. Are they
Well,
still doing what they did years ago? Are they still in control? People have
that's a
been
really
knocking
good
him, though.
question. This is probably one of the most frightening things that we're watching of our day. The United States has always been, since we've been a military power on the planet, the kind of country that if we don't like something another country's doing or it encroaches on the interests of the United States,
We have to go in there.
yeah, but we don't go in and force. What we usually do is we feed the enemy of our enemy. And we end up creating
Who
a force.
becomes our enemy?
Yeah, exactly. They use those weapons against us because they see what we did to the government that was already there. Then we try to sweep them out of the way and move in and take over the offices. And they say, no, wait a minute. No, we just took over this country. You're not removing us.
And thank you for the money, and thank you for the arms.
Right. But over time, what has happened is this agency government and the banks have succeeded in buying up all the media. And when it comes time to tell the populace what's going on, they craft their message, let's call it propaganda, and then they feed it to the media heads, and almost word for word, with very little artistic license, it goes out to the populace. And over time, those of us that are awake and we see what's going on, you start noticing this marketing campaign, and you begin to look around and see that everybody's buying it. And that's really frightening. That's what we're seeing right now with this militaristic force we call ISIS. We don't really know who they are. They cover their faces. We don't know who they are, but we can trace where they came from. And it's these same guys, it's the Kissingers of the world that have created this enemy. And the weird thing is that we face a lot of bad guys as this country, and we rise to the call and we
Sure.
go set things right.
Real bad guys.
Yeah, but they don't go on television and murder people and then say, come and get us. Come and get us. Marshal your armies. Get 100 nations if you want. Come and get us.
Yeah.
Anybody in this world knows we could end anybody we want in a long weekend.
Yep.
It doesn't make sense,
You hit
George.
them
They're
quick.
marketing something.
Yeah, well, I agree. You know, Brooks, I was talking about it the first hour. There's just something that just doesn't sound right. I mean, there if ISIS happens to be making tons of money with oil, shut it down. Shut it down. Shut down the buyers. Who's giving them the weapons?
Well, we know where the weapons came from. We know where the money came from. We know where the training and the intel comes from. So what's happening real time? I listened to one of the soldiers. He's a soldier now, a volunteer soldier, used to be in the army, now serving over there with Christian Kurds. And I listened to several of his 20-minute conversations he's had with people here in this country. They made YouTubes out of it. And something he said, everybody missed, I picked up on. I noticed one thing in the films and newsreels, all these airstrikes that we're making. We're doing a great job at blowing up old Chevy pickup trucks with a 50 caliber machine gun on the back or an old abandoned building, but there's no army, there's no soldiers in any of those pictures. And then he said something really strange. He said, when the planes take off from Turkey to come over here to do their airstrikes, the locals get a phone call. And they know when the planes are going to arrive, so they simply go in the houses, wait for the airstrike to leave, then they come out of the houses and continue fighting. And I asked myself the question, you know, I've been in the Air Force, I know how this works. We have special aircraft, we have special ground units that do nothing but blank out communications, just so airplane movements can't be forwarded. Who's making that phone call?
Oh, that's a good question.
My guess is it's probably somebody Henry Kissinger knows very well.
That's pretty big, though, Brooks.
You can't tell me that they can go do airstrikes night and day and not catch one of those patrols out doing something.
When you freely see them on videos training little five-year-olds, where are they doing this?
Well, it's, as I said, this is a well-produced, well-marketed,
campaign.
Well-propagandized marketing campaign for something. Do we really want to go to war again? Against whom? Who would we go fight? Who would we send troops over to fight? Ghosts?
I mean, and where are they? Are they in the, you know, areas of Iraq? So, you know, surrounded by citizens and, you know, innocent people? Where are they?
I would say that they're probably surrounded by oil wells, if I had my guess. Right now, there's an economic war going on against the United States, and there's some collateral damage. You'll remember that we discovered a large oil reserve in North Dakota. Now, it's not cheap oil to get out of the ground. It's expensive. It costs about $65 a barrel to extract that oil. And it's not very pleasant. It uses a lot of water. It uses a lot of power. It's messy, but it's plentiful. We spent the money, loaned the money, put the rigs in place, lowered North Dakota's unemployment to about 2%, and started drilling that. And what happened was we created an oil glut, too much supply. Now, they denied it for a while, but in a couple of years, it became apparent. The supertankers were all full. And so Saudi Arabia decided not to cut back in their production. They kept it right where it was. And sure enough, the glut ended up shoving the price of oil down. When it shoved it below $65 a barrel, all those wells in North Dakota shut off. Saudi Arabia accomplished its goal. It killed the shale oil business in the United States. And the banks that loaned all the money for all that drilling equipment and all that extraction equipment, they're left holding the bag. But there was collateral damage. There are several countries out there whose main gross domestic product comes from oil. A fraction of ours comes from that. But Russia, for instance, over half their GDP comes from oil. Venezuela, another one. So when you lower the price of oil, you make it impossible for those countries to make enough money to support their people, to support their government programs. And that creates a global tension that we're feeling everywhere.
Brooks, we're going to come back in just a moment here and take phone calls with you about the shadow government, about your electric truck, about HAARP as well, and the hollow earth. So we'll be back in a moment. Your calls and Dr. Brooks Agnew on Coast to Coast AM.